Hey, y'all. It's so great to see you. Oh, my God. You look beautiful. This is Mark Sundin. Thank you. He has written an amazing book, and I just want to say, first of all, he's come home to talk to us about it because he's a Manhattan Beach fellow. And so welcome, Mark Sundin.
Thank you.
And his folks are here in the audience, too, so we got to give him a warm welcome. Okay, he's written this book. It's called The Man Who Quit Money. Have you guys seen it yet or gotten a look at it yet? Anybody? Okay, I got to read it. It's amazing and fantastic. He's a really good writer. It's really well written. He's got wonderful credentials. He's an award-winning writer. He's done work for New York Times Magazine, for National Geographic Adventure, and many others. And he's a great travel writer, which you can tell when you read the book. So once again, welcome to Mark Sundin. And how many of you have ever gone a day without spending a dime? Just one day. Can you imagine going more than a decade without spending a dime?
No.
So Mark does this great job at the beginning of the book of kind of explaining how does this work, how does Daniel Suelo do this. And Mark, you do a great job right at the beginning in the first few pages of kind of telling these great stories and kind of explaining how it works, the basics of how Daniel lives without money. So maybe we'll start with a little rapid fire, okay, kind of like a game show, and you'll give me quick answers to the quick questions that are on probably everybody's mind, right? Okay, so no money, really? Like no currency, no exchange of currency?
No money, and in fact, no barter.
No barter.
For 11 years now.
No begging, no government assistance?
No panhandling, no welfare, no food stamps, no professional charities like homeless shelters in which the employees are being paid to be there.
Okay, so what about food? Let's go through the basics, food.
Food is foraged from nature, wild onions, watercress, mulberries, roadkill animals, and a lot of the food is taken from dumpsters and trash cans, restaurants, and a lot of food is given generously by people who he meets.
So a sort of abundance of dumpster diving.
Yes.
Okay. And he doesn't pay rent. He doesn't have a mortgage. What about shelter?
He's in a cave for much of the year in Moab, Utah. Other times of the year, he's traveling, staying with people, camping out, you know, riding the rails. And often in wintertime, people in the town of Moab, Utah will say, hey, could you come house it for me? And he'll do that because that is freely given in a cashless way.
So he does house-sitting and cave-dwelling, dumpster diving. What about clothing?
Gets clothing out of usually the dumpsters behind thrift stores.
Okay.
In fact, we were just down in the South Bay this week, and he got himself a new pair of jeans, perfectly good, out of the Salvation Army throwaways.
Mobility. How does he get around without filling a gas tank or paying for a bus card?
Well, in Moab, which is a relatively small town, he walks and rides his bike. And then when he wants to cross the country, he hitchhikes and he rides freight trains.
Is he suffering from any mental health problems?
You know, I'm not a doctor, but I have spent 2 years with him. And to the best of my knowledge, no, he seems very sane. And the rest of you can judge that for yourself when you meet him here tonight.
Okay, you mentioned giving free. Okay, so that's our lightning round. We'll go on now to deeper questions. You mentioned giving freely. He accepts when something is given freely. And in the book, you kind of illuminate, I think you do a really good job of describing that for the Western reader using a kind of an Eastern example of a monk in a bowl. Can you kind of talk about that, giving the opportunity?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, Daniel spent some time in a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, and the Buddha himself left his privileged background and began walking around, this is 2,500 years ago, with nothing but a robe, a razor, and a bowl. And his idea was to be fed by his community. And to this day, some Buddhist monks, when they collect food in their bowl, they don't say thank you because it's not an act of charity. They say, may your generosity bring you peace. In other words, they're giving the giver an opportunity to be generous, which makes that person feel good.
So, in fact, the person giving isn't on some level exercising this muscle of their heart, and the person receiving is not considered in the purest sense, in the purest exchange, not considered a beggar, but considered someone who's humbling themselves or something before.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, especially in this culture, it's more blessed to give than to receive. It's very difficult, I think, for Americans to accept something. I mean, we've been giving away books on this book tour, and people say, oh, can I pay you for it? And I say, you know, the publisher agreed to give away several hundred books at libraries and churches. And people are shocked. They say, what do I have to do in exchange? So, yeah, he's accepting without obligation or guilt, and he's giving freely what he has without expectation of return.
So then where does work come in terms of the way we think of it? Like, we work, we get a salary. Yep. And we do things with that salary.
Well, Daniel does work. In fact, he took one of the toughest jobs in America one summer, which was working on a fishing boat in Alaska. And the other deckhand made $10,000, and Daniel took nothing except the plane fare up there, or the captain bought him the ticket, and then he was fed while he was on the boat. But other than that, he did it because he wanted to see the Aleutian Islands, and he wanted to have an adventure. Some of the other stuff he does is work, is volunteers at a women's shelter, volunteers at a community garden, and volunteers at what was called a free meal program. I don't know if you ever heard of Food Not Bombs. It was a similar program to that, where people gathered together, got food from restaurants, and served a free lunch every day. And there are other ways he works which are probably not easily quantified in monetary terms, and we might touch on those later, I guess.
So tell us the genesis of this book idea. Did you get the idea to write this book, and how did that unfold? And then when you actually met Daniel, how did your encounter go in terms of what you expected to see based on all these kinds of questions, and then what you actually found when you met Daniel?
Okay, so I had known Daniel almost 20 years ago, before he gave it money. We were working as cooks in a restaurant in Moab, Utah. I just graduated from Stanford. Daniel had been got a degree from Boulder in Colorado. He'd been in the Peace Corps. But we both were not interested in pursuing a more ambitious career, which is why we were cooks.
In Moab.
I was living in my car at the time. Daniel was, the next summer, he started living in the canyon for the first time. And over the years, we drifted apart, but I heard through mutual friends that he had stopped using money and was living in a cave. And I thought, okay, he's lost his mind, and it's very sad. He's gone crazy, but what other explanation is there? And, you know, he was saying money is an illusion, which I simply didn't believe, because I knew that if I had $20, I could take it down to the store and exchange this thing for food, which was not an illusion. So I didn't give it much thought. Then in 2008... or 2009, actually, another writer from Moab published a story about him in Details magazine with the headline, you know, you think you can live without money, that having the stock market just collapsed. Well, this guy's been doing it for 10 years. And a publisher in New York read this, and they sent an email to Daniel, because he's got a blog he writes, which he publishes free on the public library computers. And they wrote to him and said, do you want to write a book about your life? And he said, I'd be interested, but of course I couldn't accept money for it, and I would want the book to be given away for free. And Penguin was only partially interested in that idea, I guess. And so they then asked if he would be open to the idea of having another writer write a book about him. And they contacted me because I had lived in Moab. I knew them from a previous book. And they said, have you heard of this guy in the cave? And I said, yeah, I know him. He's my friend on Facebook.
We're tight like that.
And so a book deal came together. And Daniel, of course, didn't ask to be paid. He did ask, or he requested but didn't demand that books be made available to the public for free. And as I've mentioned, we've did about 6 or 7 events across the country where Penguin has held that promise. So that was nice. The second part of the question was, how was meeting him different than I expected? So I went down to Moab. I sent him some emails. I said, I'm going to be here on such and such a date. And then I got there and I didn't hear from him. And I was waiting around. You know, I was very punctual. I was like, okay, I've been here 2 days. He hasn't responded to my email. Where is he? How can I find him? There's thousands and thousands of caves around here. I wouldn't know where to begin. And in what was one of the first of many serendipitous events that happened while I was writing this book, sitting on the porch of my friend's house, and he rides by on his bicycle. And I hadn't seen him in 10 years at that point, but I was, oh, okay, I think that's him. And I chased him down. And
wait, serendipitous? He wasn't riding over to get you?
He hadn't even got my email yet. He hadn't been to the library and checked the email. He just happened to be cruising by, and he had a bunch of...
And you saw him out the window?
I was on the porch.
On his two-wheeler.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he had a bunch of apples and oranges in the back of his bicycle in a crate. And so I brought him inside to my friend's house where I was staying, and it just so happened that my friend Melanie was absolutely addicted to eating watermelons. And she had had this mysterious illness, and watermelons had cured her. She put them in a blender, and she ate them 3 times a day. And it was the fall. Watermelon season was over. She was kind of in a panic as to, how am I going to get more watermelons? Am I going to have to order them off the internet? And Daniel walks up, and he says, oh, don't you know about the melon patch? And we said, no. And he led us across, literally across the street, behind the neighbor's house, into a big open field in the middle of the town of Moab. And some man who owned the land had planted hundreds of melons, anticipating that the economy was going to collapse with the election of President Obama. And when the economy and the food systems didn't collapse, he just said, well, I don't need these melons anyway. So Daniel had been eating them for months. And he took us over there. It was just this beautiful day. I mean, it was sunny and gorgeous, and it was like the Garden of Eden. You know, there was ripe fruit everywhere, and everything was free, and we just started picking them and eating them and having this feast, and it had this mystical, almost supernatural feeling to it. And I ended up making this the first chapter of my book, because it was just a magical moment that doesn't happen when you walk around with your wallet out ready to buy food. You know, suddenly Melanie needed her watermelons, and they appeared.
And he wasn't wearing a cape while he was riding that bike?
Nope, no cape.
So, do you think we should bring Daniel up now?
Yeah.
Daniel Suelo is here to join us. Welcome, Daniel Suelo.
Hello.
Okay, so my editor wanted me to ask you first, how did you get here? How did you get here? She's like wondering, how does he get around? How did he get here if he's not going to spend money to get here?
Well, actually, I rode with Mark. On his,
you accepted a ride freely.
He was coming this way anyway, and I decided to come with him.
Now, tell us about your name. You weren't born with the name Daniel Suelo.
Yeah, my birth name is Daniel Schellebarger.
Schellebarger,
yeah. And Suelo came pretty much by accident, random. I was tree-sitting a few years back, I don't remember how many years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, in Oregon, and I had this other tree-sit name up there, and I was supposed to be officially arrested, but they didn't really know who I was because I had a different name. And then when I came down, when the tree-sit was over, some friends were introducing me to some other friends in a little cafe, and they said, oh, quick, you have to think of another name because you can't use your old name. And I just glanced up at this bumper sticker that said, all soil is sacred, and the first thing that flashed into my mind was Suelo. It's soil in Spanish. So
very cool.
So there we go.
And now, Mr. Suelo, you are basically actually a caveman with a blog.
Yeah.
That's tell us about that. You live in a cave, you ride your bike to the library, and you do a blog, a regular blog.
Yeah. when I first started living moneyless, maybe after the first year, I decided to do a website on living without money. I think I called it American Sadhu or something like that.
American
Sadhu. And a sadhu is someone who is sort of like a Hindu mendicant that lives without money in India. But I had that blog just for a short time, or not a blog, a website with frequently asked questions. And I sort of felt like calling myself a sadhu was kind of pretentious, and I had a lot of ego wrapped around the website, so I decided to zap it. And I went for several years without it because I felt like it was taking my mind out of the present moment, which is the point of living this way. And then a few years later, some people they kept asking me if I was going to make a website again and a blog, so I finally gave in and did it like 4 or 5 years ago.
So you give updates on your lifestyle.
Yeah.
And you talked about living in the present moment. Tell us about that moment that's in the book where you go into a phone booth, but that's arcane now. But anyway, I think you're at a phone booth, according to the book, and you drop your last 30 bucks there, and you walk away. You empty your wallet, you leave it there, and you walk away. That's your last money, and you haven't had money in your pockets.
Yeah. I had, I started out in Nova Scotia with the idea that I was going to live without money, and I met this other person, Lorelei. She had the same ideas. So we were going to hitchhike down the East Coast to Virginia and not use any money. But I had this $50 in my back pocket as a security. It was my little insurance policy. And I kept finding I was feeling this anxiety. Like, what am I doing? I'm away from everybody I know, except I had Lorelei there. But I don't have any money, and I must be nuts. But I kept thinking my mind kept going toward my back pocket where that money was, and then I realized, well, I'm putting a lot of faith in this piece of paper, these pieces of paper in my back pocket. Maybe that's the problem. And I felt like, wow, I could give up enough money this far, why can't I give up my last $50? And also, my sister had been hounding me about a parking ticket I left in Seattle, so I sent part of it to her, and then I left the rest in a phone booth. And it was this total feeling of liberation. It was like, I felt like it was warm water pouring over my head, and just this total comfort, feeling like, wow, everywhere I go, I'm at home, and everywhere I go, I'm employed. You know, the universe is my employer. It's like I'm always at home, and I'm always employed. It was this intense feeling of security.
Didn't feel crazy at all?
No. No, it felt like...
I know you guys have tons of questions. We're going to go to you guys soon, so... start thinking about what you want to ask, and there's going to be a couple people with microphones, so wait to get the microphone, because we're going to put all the sound up on the web for your friends and folks who haven't gotten to come here today so that they can download it. So it's going to be, all this is going to be on the website, so get your questions ready and wait for the microphone and say your question into that. So we'll be doing that in a couple minutes. So you talked about there's a lot of places in the journey, and maybe I'm just going to go right to one of the most dramatic places, if I may. Your book and your life, it is something of a journey, and like any good road story, you know, Thelma and Louise, they sail off that cliff, right, at the end. But right for you, it's right in the middle, and I want to get both of you guys' point of view on this, but there's this moment, I think it's 91, but there's this moment in time when Daniel, and we can go back and tell the rest of the story, but Daniel is feeling down and decides it's time to, before he's given up money and decides it's time to end this life, you get behind the wheel of a car, you hit the gas really hard, and you sail off a cliff. Tell us the story. What brought, and what happens after your car is in mid-flight off that cliff?
Well, I was living in Boulder at the time. I just moved to Boulder from Denver. I was doing social work in Denver and going through severe clinical depression and thinking, wow, I can't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And the idea of ending it all was the first happy thought I'd had in a long time. So I remembered, like, most of my life I spent in Colorado. My dad would take us up to Mount Evans, which at that time was the highest mountain road in the world. I don't know if it still is, but I loved it up there. And then I remembered there were cliffs up there. So I decided to, one morning before sunrise, to drive up there and end it all. And I went up the road, and at first I thought, well, I could just walk up to the side of the cliff and jump off. But that was too scary. So I decided to get in my car. I know it was illogical, but... went pretty much near the summit. There's a cliff that drops off, I don't know, 500 or more feet, and there's a lake at the bottom. And it was really foggy in the morning, and I found the spot where I wanted to go off, and there were some mountain goats coming down the mountain at that time, and they just like appeared through the fog. And I was feeling really sad, but also like the whole world was really beautiful, but I was thinking, wow, this is the last time I'm going to see it. And then these goats came up to the car, and I rolled down my window, and one of them stuck his head right there at the window, and it's like we peered at each other, looked right into his black, deep eyes, and it was almost like I felt this communication with him. He was like, just total non-judgment, like he was saying, do what you got to do. And then I pounced the gas and went toward the edge, and it wasn't really in mid-flight, I don't think, but right as I was going off the edge, this thought flashed in my head. It was like a prayer or a thought, and it was like, if God has a purpose for me, then not even I can resist it. And then off I went, and then I just remember blacking out. And later on, I wake up, and I just saw red, like blood and glass. That's all I remembered. And then thinking, oh, shit, I'm still alive. And I was... Because the worst thought, the worst thing that I could imagine was attempting something that I felt was fail-safe. Like, I wanted this to be fail-safe. I didn't want to be rescued. I didn't want it to fail. And there I was alive, and I felt angry. But I didn't feel anything physically, and I felt tired. I thought, well, there's no way I can survive this. I'm just going to drift off and go to sleep. So I just passed out, thinking I wouldn't wake up again. It was kind of a peaceful feeling. Then who knows how much longer I was there, and I woke up again, and this time it was pain all over, and the blood and cold. I was like shivering with hypothermia, and I was still angry. And then I thought, I can't drift off again. It's just too painful, and I'm cold. And this survival instinct kicked in. And then I remember thinking, I got to get up to the road. And then I remember blacking out again. And the next thing I remembered, I was up at the side of the road. I don't remember even climbing up there. And then I remember, I don't think Mark put this in the book, but I remember this, hearing this car from above. It was early in the morning. I was thinking, why would any fool be up here this early in the morning? You know, I heard this car coming down, And I kept swinging back and forth between wanting to live and wanting to die. And then I was thinking, I felt ashamed lying there and that I wanted to die. And I thought, I hope he passes by. I don't want him, you know, I just want to die. And sure enough, he passed me by. And then all of a sudden I just go, why did he do that? It's like, why? It's like, I was like, what's with these? Why would anybody pass somebody by in a pool of blood on the road? then I was like hoping to live again. It's like, oh man, that was my chance, and now I'm going to die up here, and I want to live. Then I started praying that somebody else would come, and then sure enough, I heard this other car coming down from the summit. I was like, wow, what's everybody doing up here this early in the morning and in the middle of the week? And he came down, and it was a van, and he saw me there, and he put a blanket on me and said that he would go get help, took off. And then I woke up again, and the helicopter was there and took me to the hospital in Denver. Anyway.
Wow. So you do such a brilliant job in the book of describing this, and can you take it from there and sort of explain it, how you kind of take this as, I don't know how to say it, some kind of heroic, like the turning point in a hero story or the turning point in a mythic kind of tale. Can you explain
that
a little bit?
Yeah, so it's similar to the story about the watermelons, and which seemed kind of magical, and then I heard this story and it seemed kind of miraculous. And I'd already done, you know, I had 100 pages of interviews with Daniel, single-spaced, and I'd read all these books about his philosophy. And I was trying to say, how could I convey this? Because to me, it started to seem like more than just a life story. It seemed like a myth to me. And so sure enough, I started reading about mythology, and all the pieces came together. You know, in the hero's journey, you have an unwilling hero who gets called into his adventure against his own will, sort of like Bilbo Baggins or Luke Skywalker. And that's what I felt, is that Daniel didn't want to have an adventure. He wanted to die. But someone or something prevented that from happening. And one of the elements of the hero's journey is called the supernatural aid, when things like that occur. And the hero becomes aware that there's more to life than is on the surface, that there is another dimension, a spiritual dimension maybe, that they weren't aware of. And so the hero's journey consists, according to Joseph Campbell, of the initiation, the departure, and the return. And so I saw this as kind of his initiation, and then the departure being setting out to find the meaning of life in monasteries around the world and going to the Dalai Lama and paring down all of his existence to the most bare bones. And then the return was sort of after he gave up money, maybe what he was just talking about starting this blog 5 years ago. The hero comes back and says, I've learned something, and I'm willing to share it.
Interesting. Well, and so you make your way around on your bike and on foot from your different areas of Moab and such. And when people see you, what do they think? What do they say? Is there anything sort of obvious? This guy has a different lifestyle, or?
Well, the thing about Moab is it's not that big of a deal there. It's
kind of a groovy hippie town.
I should just say, when I went down to Moab to start writing this book, and I was telling people I was writing about the guy in the cave, they're like, "Oh, which one?"
Oh. Okay, well, let me put it like this. Let me change the question a little bit then. You talked about how, you know, sometimes you run into authorities. There you are, sort of living off the land, on the streets, etc. When you run into authorities and they say, what are you doing? What do you say to them?
Well, in Moab, the authorities leave me alone pretty much. When I'm hitchhiking, cops stop me a lot. it's like commonplace, and sometimes I get really tired of it because I feel like I'm just walking in America. And that's what I'd like to tell cops. They say, well, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm walking in America. And invariably they get taken aback by that because that's what I'm doing. And it's a free country. And Mark kind of talks about that in the book, that it resonates with cops because they're often veterans and they're usually conservative, and they believe that this is a free country and we should be able to walk in it without harassment.
Okay, well, that sort of leads to this question. You're walking in America. It's a free country. You should be allowed to walk in it. Veterans and authorities are asking you. So in America, we are America. We are democracy. We are a capitalistic society. And sort of those are all so intertwined right now, right? A lot of people see